Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Jason Howell and I, Micah Sargent, have, well, a longer show planned for you today. First, we talk to TechCrunch's own Alex Wilhelm about, yes, Silicon Valley Bank. It is time to talk about SVB. What's going on? What are the morals involved? And what can we expect in the future? Then, JD Capoluto from Semaphore stops by to talk about the newly announced, newly released GPT-4. How does it compare to GPT-3? How can you make use of it? And what all can it do? Before we round things out with our stories of the week, up first, it's about TikTok. Yes, Jason Howell talks about the Biden administration's planned ban for TikTok. And then I talk about Microsoft announcing Copilot, which is like a futuristic Clippy that runs on GPT-4. It's incredible. All of that is coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 277, recorded Thursday, March 16th, 2023.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ZocDoc. When you're not feeling your best and just trying to hold it together, finding great care shouldn't take up all of your energy. Go to ZocDoc.com/TNW and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find a top-rated doctor today. Many are available within 24 hours.
And by Decisions. Don't let complexity block your company's growth. Decisions no-code, rules-driven process automation software provides every tool needed to build custom workflows, empowering you to modernize legacy systems, ensure regulatory compliance, and renew the customer experience. Visit decisions.com/twit to learn how automating anything can change everything.
And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. Hello and welcome back to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
I'm the other guy, Jason Howell. Today we're going to start things off talking about making and then breaking the bank.
Oh, yeah, that bank.
Actually, it's kind of funny because Silicon Valley Bank, like a week ago, maybe a little bit longer than a week ago, because if it was a week ago, we would have been talking about it on the show. But it like came with this fury.
Yeah.
And over the weekend, it was like, the sky is falling.
Yes.
And then now this week, it's been relatively quiet, or maybe I just haven't been in, you know, the whirlpool, so to speak. But thought we would bring on today's episode someone who has been in that whirlpool, at least following it closer than I have. I only got caught up in the mayhem. I'm curious to know what's happened since the mayhem. So we have Alex Wilhelm from TechCrunch joining us to talk all about it. Welcome back, Alex.
Hey, it's great to be here. I feel like whenever something breaks, I get to come on your fine show. It'd be fun to come on a week when nothing was happening. And just
oh, boy. You have no idea. When nothing's happening, the show can actually be kind of difficult because it's like, what do we talk about? It's like we need things to break in order to break the news.
I can come up with some jokes. I can do a little comedy set for you guys if you get desperate. I'm just saying, like, we don't have to wait for a crisis to have me on.
When we just want to hang out, and we've got an episode where it's like, we don't have any news, so we're just going to hang out. We will contact you and we'll bring you on for the hangout episode.
Sold.
All right, cool. Well, we do have things to talk about, though, this time. This is, of course, Silicon Valley Bank, the collapse that happened at the tail end of last week, the mayhem that ensued that I already referred to this weekend, and then everything that's happened since throughout this week. But let's start with maybe a little brief timeline from last week when things were kind of ramping up. It kind of hit like a ton of bricks. What happened there, and talk a little bit about kind of the panic that was induced as a result.
Yeah, so I'm going to take us back a little bit and be very brief. But after 2008, banking crisis, we had a bunch of regulations for banks. Those were amended during the Trump administration, creating less regulation for slightly smaller banks. Silicon Valley Bank fit into that kind of tranche of banking. And then last week, on Wednesday after trading ended, Silicon Valley Bank announced to shareholders and the public at large, they were going to sell some stock, take an investment hit, reinvest some of their capital, and also up their borrowing. And so Thursday morning of last week, when I woke up to see their share price down 20% or so, I thought the market was just peevish that there was going to be some dilution and a financial charge, and the bank was just kind of being punished for being a little bit naughty. It turned out, however, that the bank had been sitting on a lot more unrealized losses than people were really aware of, and so it was trying to shore up its financials. And then it turned out that a bank really doesn't traffic in money, it traffics in trust. And when it decided to make these changes, it began to lose that trust with its depositors. So on Thursday, it had a little meeting with its venture capital customers that I snuck my way into on Zoom and I watched. And it turned out that their entire pitch was, please trust us and don't have a run on the bank. And then everyone went out and did a run on the bank.
Please don't do that. And then everybody did that. Because then, as you mentioned, trust is pivotal in kind of the economy at large, the financial system. I mean, a dollar doesn't have value unless we all believe and trust that that dollar has value. And that's kind of at the core of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. And then once the run began, the panic spread, as you can kind of imagine, across private networks, text messages, Twitter. Everyone was just talking about this because there is so much money inside of Silicon Valley Bank. So anyways, by the end of the week, it was clear that this was not going to work. The government stepped in, and it turned out that $42 billion had been taken out of the bank so quickly that the bank essentially went insolvent. Then the weekend hit, as you said, and everyone began to freak out because so many startups and other small businesses banked at Silicon Valley Bank. And if they couldn't access their money, well, then they couldn't make payroll this week. And so people were concerned, what's going to happen to these deposits? And as I'm sure everyone here who has a bank account knows, FDIC insurance is up to $250,000 per account. It turns out that's not really true. If there's a big enough problem, it's unlimited. Woo! So the government stepped in and said, hey, you know, we're going to kind of make sure this all works out. Everyone will have access to their money at the start of the week. And then Monday came and things began to, you know, lose a little bit of their temperature, if you will.
Yeah. Were you surprised by Sunday's news? It actually happened during the Twit live stream where the announcement was released that the depositors would be fully protected. Did that surprise you? Because, I mean, at that point, it was kind of interesting because Twit started with, as you can imagine, a huge discussion around the potentials of what might happen. And then by the end of the episode, it was like, oh, okay, so everything's going to be all right. Was it surprising?
No. Because this is a financial system that is designed to keep stability over morality. And so, you know, if you, Jason Howell, mismanaged your finances poorly and lost the faith of your bank and went bankrupt, the government wouldn't give a half dang.
No.
But if you're a Silicon Valley bank, then you can just call up all your friends in Congress and put a lot of pressure on things and get the ball rolling. In this country, if you make a big enough mess, you don't get in trouble, you get helped.
Right.
And so in this case, that's what happened. And it's depressing to me because this ended up devolving into kind of a Twitter fight between people who were annoyed that libertarian-leaning venture capitalists were running to government and going, please help, please help. After they had, you know, poo-pooed things like, you know, student loan bailouts and so forth. Ultimately, we live in a society, we're all interconnected, and it's good to be reminded of that. But, you know, I think there was some hypocrisy at play here that was frustrating. Even though I do think it was the right thing to do, because as you said, the contagion was tampered down. And by Monday, things seemed to be much less chaotic and terrifying, which is good for business, which is good for everybody.
Yeah. And mind you, like the contagion that you're talking about doesn't necessarily mean just SVB. If trust in, you know, in the out the whatever the fallout of this whole SVB saga means that everybody else is looking at their bank going, oh, well, holy cow, like, do I need to, you know, it's like that doubt is introduced. And then suddenly you have, you know, the run on the banks and everything. And I think that's what people were afraid of. Well, I know that's what a lot of people were afraid of. And thankfully that didn't happen or hasn't happened yet. Are we kind of in the clear at this point, or what do you think there?
Well, let me give people an example. So let's say Jason was banking at Silicon Valley Bank and Micah was over at First Republic. Okay. And Micah watches SVB go through the absolute mincer over a 4 or 5 day period. And he's sitting there looking at his accounts and going, well, am I safe at this other smaller bank, or should I take my money out and put it in an enormous bank? And so part of the things that people wanted to avoid was having Micah leave First Republic or another smaller regional bank. And yeah, it's hard to tell where we are on that yet. First Republic, to pick another example of a tech-friendly mid-sized bank is under a lot of pressure lately. Outflows of deposits, concerns about stability, and we've seen its share prices whipsaw up and down. So I think the initial crisis has been solved, but we're still really chewing on the second and third order effects. And I don't think anybody knows exactly how different the financial landscape, not just for tech startups, but for business in general, will be.
What kind of startups? Because it really sounds like SVB was filled with startup clientele that were going to be drastically and impressively impacted by this if the Federal Reserve, you know, didn't make that announcement on Sunday and changes, you know, that help that you talked about wasn't ushered in. What kind of companies do we know of had that potential impact? And they've got to be breathing a big sigh of relief at this point.
Well, it's a great question because the answer is a bunch. I mean, everything from
many of the ones we know.
Well, I was getting there.
Okay.
a myriad of companies from the smallest seed stage startup that only had a couple hundred thousand dollars all the way up to Roku, a company that I'm sure has been on the Twit network a lot because they make hardware, which is a public company now. It had $250 million there. In the crypto world, Circle, which backs the USDC stablecoin, the second largest one, had $3.3 billion there. And lots of other companies had, you know, $10 million there, $50 million there, whatever it was. So it ran the whole spectrum of kind of the tech business world, the people who build the stuff that we kind of get excited about, right? And does it make sense in retrospect to have put all of those eggs in one small basket? Turns out, no, but there were advantages to banking at Silicon Valley Bank that did make it the bank of choice. It's not an accident that it was popular. I'm just curious to see if who's going to kind of take up that mantle next, and if we're ever going to see a similar situation happen again, or if people will be more risk conscious.
Yeah, I don't know about that last one. People are given time and time again an opportunity to be more risk conscious, and I think people just tend to get dazzled by the possibilities if they aren't. So what does happen next now? And is there anything in your view, kind of looking forward from where we're at right now, that gives you some concern about the direction that this, kind of the fallout of this might take?
Yeah, so because deposit insurance seems to be effectively unlimited, I think that this means that mid-sized and smaller banks will retain a customer base, because otherwise people were just going to leave and go bank at, you know, Chase or Goldman or whatever, some bank that's just too big to fail, you know? Mm-hmm. The question that I have is, what happens to the world of fintech? Now, fintech startups raised roughly one in every $5 over the last couple of years. They're one of the biggest venture capital bets ever. And, you know, things like Chime and Stripe and other kind of relatively big names in the tech and finance world are now in this fintech bucket. And if the consumer and business worlds get more conservative, do fintech startups just slowly decline and fail? I'm very curious about the next steps for a big chunk of the kind of tech startup world. I don't think we know how they're going to do yet because they're not public, so they don't have to tell us. But I'm concerned about how attractive they'll be as places to put and move money in this now seemingly riskier world that we live in.
Yes. Yes, indeed. In many different cases, you are absolutely right. You're always right, Alex. That's why we love talking with you. Thank you for coming on, Alex Wilhelm from TechCrunch. Definitely go to TechCrunch.com, search up Alex's work. He's written about this, of course. And yeah, it's always awesome getting you on, Alex. If people want to follow you online, obviously TechCrunch, where can they find you?
Oh, I'm just on Twitter. My Twitter name is Alex, but really, you should look up Jason's music and give that a spin because it's quite nice.
Wow. Thank you, man. That was unexpected.
Jason Howell on Spotify, I believe, right?
Yellow Gold. No, I don't know.
No, that's Jason Howell.
When will you be sending him the gift card that you promised him for?
Not the Raspberry Rallies?
when he dropped an album, I went through and listened to it through, and I thought it was quite nice. He's a much better guitar player than I am. So.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. It's always a pleasure, man. We will talk to you soon, Alex. Thank you again.
All right. Bye,
Alex. Take care.
All righty, folks. Up next, the next version of OpenAI's ChatGPT is here. What does that mean? Well, we'll get that answer shortly. But first, let me tell you about our first sponsor this week. It's ZocDoc, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. There's honestly nothing worse than going to a doctor's appointment expecting to be the center of attention, And then your doctor seems like they have better things to do and better places to be. Instead of listening to you intently, asking you how you feel, helping you along, the doctor is constantly looking at their watch or checking the clock, trying to say, okay, I got to get to this next appointment. On ZocDoc, you will find quality doctors who focus on you, who listen to you, and who prioritize your care. ZocDoc is the only free app that lets you find and book doctors who are patient reviewed, take your insurance, and are available when you need them, and treat almost every condition under the sun. When you're not feeling your best and you're just trying to hold it together, that's the worst time to be trying to find a doctor and having to think about all of the different aspects of what it takes to find the doctor. It shouldn't be hard to do. It shouldn't take up all of that energy that you have, that very little bit of energy that you have when you're feeling unwell. That's where ZocDoc comes in. Using their free app that already millions of users rely on, you can find the right doctor that meets your needs and fits your schedule. Book an appointment with a few taps in the app and start feeling better with ZocDoc. Go to ZocDoc.com/TNW and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find a top-rated doctor today. Many are available within 24 hours. That's ZocDoc.com/TNW. ZocDoc.com/TNW. And thank you, ZocDoc, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right. So you may have heard that GPT, OpenAI's large language model, has gotten an update. And with that has come a whole host of interesting changes. And I think a lot of folks who are excited about what's next for GPT. Joining us today to talk about what's going on with GPT is Semaphore's own JD Capiluto. Welcome to the show, JD.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to get you on. So let's, of course, start with the basics, because we do get new listeners to the show. We do get listeners who may not be super steeped in tech like we are. Tell us about OpenAI's GPT technology. Just in general, what is OpenAI's GPT before we even start getting into those numbers of 3 and 4?
Yeah, essentially, it can get confusing. So for those who aren't super familiar, it's essentially OpenAI's large language learning model that powers what we know, what many people know of as ChatGPT, which is their chatbot. It essentially is trained on over 100 billion pieces of tech data from across, or text data, excuse me, I'm in a tech headspace here, text data from across the internet, and essentially uses that to, when you ask it a question, to predict the next word that comes next. So it essentially just guesses what it thinks is the most likely word to complete a phrase or a sentence. And it essentially has been evolved over time, over the years, to power, like I said, what we know of as ChatGPT, which is how it gets its name.
So it's very smart autocorrect.
Essentially, yes.
Yes.
By guessing, you know, in your predictive text on your phone, when you're guessing what the next word would be, it's a much better version of that, because that one isn't super good.
Not great, right. Well, so one of the things that I think is important to understand, and I've seen some confusion here, is a lot of times ChatGPT and then GPT-3, which up to this point has been the sort of system behind it, those get conflated. And so I was hoping that you could explain the difference when we're talking about ChatGPT and we're just talking about GPT itself. What's the difference there?
Right. So the way that I like to think about it is that ChatGPT is the chatbot that we know, where you can go in and ask it questions and it'll respond. GPT is kind of the underlying technology that powers that. So ChatGPT uses what's called actually GPT 3.5 to make things even more confusing with more numbers. It's essentially built on top of GPT-3 and is a fine-tuned version of that. But essentially, the tech itself is GPT, and then the chatbot that we all know and love is ChatGPT. And it uses, like I said, 3.5. And now we have 4. So it kind of continues that evolution.
Got it. So moving on to the update, we saw OpenAI announce GPT-4 and start to kind of show that off. Could you tell us about the difference between GPT-3 and GPT-4? And then we'll dig into some of the details of the two.
Yeah, so it essentially does what ChatGPT does, but a lot better in terms of its language skills and its cognitive reasoning. It can analyze way more text and kind of synthesize it down to kind of whatever you want it to be. So I think it can take up to 25,000 words of text and kind of as input. It's much better. We've seen at things like math and at cognitive reasoning, sometimes you would give the current ChatGPT, you would give it like a logic puzzle or something that requires like a slightly higher level of thinking, and it just wouldn't be able to get there. GPT-4 is there in terms of its cognitive skills. And one thing that it has that ChatGPT doesn't have is that it can take images as input. You can send it a photo, apparently, and it'll be able to describe it and analyze what's in it. That hasn't been publicly released yet, apparently, because of fears of it being abused, which kind of speaks to this broader question of responsible AI. But that is something that we've seen a bit in the demos that apparently GPT-4 can do, which is a really huge advancement in terms of understanding, kind of bringing in the visual aspect of it as well.
Yeah, and you talked about, you know, sort of the concerns there. The OpenAI has talked about how GPT-4 is quote unquote safer, and that kind of is a broad term that has many different underlying pieces. Can you tell us about what's going on there?
What I think they mean by that is that they say that GPT-4 is 82% less likely to produce a response to something where the content is not allowed. So they have some things like, if we've seen with ChatGPT, if people ask it like information on like how to commit a crime or like tell an offensive joke or something, it'll be like, no, you know, that's not right. I'm not going to do that. We've seen some people be able to kind of jailbreak it, is what they call it, and go around it, which I don't know why people are like going out of their way to try to tell offensive jokes, but it does test the limits of this kind of thing. And so in that way, I guess it can be helpful. But apparently GPT-4 is more trained to kind of not reveal as many of those pieces of content that aren't allowed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. So where before you could more than likely get it to do something that it's not supposed to be doing, now it becomes more difficult. It's going to be more convoluted process if you are going to get it to do something.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. I've been kind of trolling the ChatGPT Reddit, kind of scrolling through it. Kind of where a lot of people test out different things, and already seeing people say that GPT-4 is a little more restrictive, they say, which again can be a good thing if you're trying to avoid harmful content. But that seems to be what OpenAI means by that.
Got it. Now, one of the terms you use in the piece, and it's one of, I find, the most fascinating things about these chat bots or this large language model technology, it's hallucinations. Can you tell us, in terms of AI, what does it mean when an AI is hallucinating?
Yeah, so it's essentially, if you think of what we as humans think of as hallucinating, when you see something and you think you see it and you're sure it's there, but it's actually not there, it's the same for an AI, where it so confidently believes that something is correct and is just wrong about it, and really believes that it's right, even though it's wrong, and that it's not backed up really by its training data, and it can be really confusing. And those are some of the viral examples that went around with ChatGPT of like, oh my God, it believes, you know, XYZ. What? This makes no sense. They say that GPT-4 has less of those and should be a little more accurate, but they still say that it has some problems with hallucinations that they're working to figure out. So those are some of the limits that are going to continue to be tested over these next few weeks, I believe.
Got it. Now, one of the things that OpenAI showed off were some different examples of how GPT-4 works in terms of in comparison to GPT-3. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about some of the examples that they showed in the event, and then also talk about its improved performance on standardized exams, because that was another big factor. Yeah. It seems to be that it's a little more creative than it was before. But tell us all about that.
Yeah. So in terms of the examples, one thing, it showed off kind of how it can distill a lot of complicated information. This was, I should mention, a demonstration that OpenAI president and co-founder Greg Brockman did after GPT-4 was released, and it was mostly for developers. I'm not a developer, but I still found it super interesting just as a journalist and a user. He showed how it can distill a lot of complicated information and kind of analyze that. He copied, I believe, 26 pages of the US tax code into GPT-4 and asked it a very complicated tax question that I definitely wouldn't have been able to answer on my own. And it pretty much immediately spit out the answer. So that was one example on the text side of things. Then he showed off the image capabilities, which again isn't in any of OpenAI's GPT models up until now. He sent it a photo of a screenshot of a Discord chat that they were using during the demo, and it and he asked it to describe in painstaking detail what it was describing. He didn't even say whether it was a screenshot or what, but it noticed that it was, and it perfectly described what was in this screenshot. Wow. And then what was the coolest example? Yeah, it was when he basically during the demo took a photo of a scribble, like a mock-up of a website that he wanted to make, just that it was on a notepad. He sent it a photo and it was like in his handwriting and, you know, just kind of drawn out really quickly, it looked like. And he basically asked it, make a website of this mock-up using JavaScript and HTML. And it immediately output this website, which, you know, was way beyond, I think, my capabilities, at least. It was relatively simple, but it involved a button that you had to click, and it just immediately understood it. And again, this was a demo, so who knows if they tested to make sure that it would be good ahead of time, but it was still really, really cool to instantly see like a little scribble on a piece of paper drawn out, or just created into a website.
Yeah.
And that's really impressive.
That's incredibly impressive. And what I think there is especially impressive is like all of the different contexts that you're talking about, because right. you've got, and even I remember reading about in that Discord chat, there was a photo, and it was a photo of a squirrel like holding a
yes.
Camera. And so not only did ChatGPT explain in painstaking detail, or not ChatGPT, but GPT-4 explain in painstaking detail what the photo was in general, but then to go on and say, and why is that photo that's in this screenshot? So or what's funny about this photo? And it was able to provide the context there, which we all know the way that you make a joke even funnier is by explaining it. But even though it may not have a sense of humor, I still find that incredibly impressive.
Yeah. No. And in terms of understanding like the cognitive reasoning around like why it was humorous for a squirrel to be taking a photo of a nut that it had found, like that is something that ChatGPT never would be able to do in its current form. So it was really, really cool to see that. And I've seen in terms of the coding ability, that's something that I should have mentioned earlier that is much more sophisticated on GPT-4. People I've already seen on Twitter being able to make like snake games to play on their computer, or like a little game of like electronic Pong, just immediately being able to turn it around with GPT-4. So that's been really, really cool. But on the standardized tests angle, one thing that was kind of went viral with ChatGPT after it was released was people kind of putting it to the test of like, oh, I made ChatGPT take a Wharton exam, or I made it take the bar and see how it did. This time around, OpenAI put GPT-4 to the test before it was released and kind of detailed all of those results in its report, which was really interesting compared to how ChatGPT would do. And it did much better on the bar. It was scored in the 90th percentile of the bar compared to ChatGPT, which was in the 10th percentile. Did much better on wow. calculus. It got a 4 on the AP Calculus BC exam compared to the 1 that ChatGPT got. One thing where it didn't do as well, though, which is really important to still know, was writing in English. It got a 2 on the AP English and Language Literature and Composition exams, and which was the same as what ChatGPT got. So obviously, that requires a little more original thinking and writing. So that's kind of an important limitation to note when it comes to these large language AI models that are essentially scraping existing text that's on the internet and kind of repurposing them.
Wow. That's fascinating though, to see it, do as well as it did on some of those yeah. exams. And even there was what the LEET code, is that what it's called? The LEET code. Exam?
Yes. The LEET code exam is essentially something, a course and test that coders can take to like test their skills, and they have different versions of it. ChatGPT did pretty poorly, especially on the advanced version. GPT-4 did better on the easy version. It got like a 31 out of 41, out of a possible 41. But in terms of the advanced one, which apparently requires a little bit more original thinking and a little more being more abstract, it got like a 3 out of 45 or something like that. So it still did very poorly on the advanced coding. So obviously room for improvement there.
Absolutely. Now, will folks be able to use GPT-4 by way of ChatGPT, or is the service still using and will continue to just use GPT 3.5, as you point out? Will we all eventually get access to GPT-4, or is this only going to be an API accessible technology?
Yeah, so right now anyone can get access to GPT-4 if they're a paid subscriber of what's called ChatGPT Plus, which costs $20 a month, and it essentially will provide you with access to GPT-4 in the similar chatbot context. So essentially, yes, but right now, if you're not a paid subscriber, you only still get the regular ChatGPT.
Got it.
Got it.
Now, as we've covered on the show in the past, Microsoft, of course, invested billions of dollars into OpenAI and in even went as far as to add OpenAI's tech to its Bing search engine. My question is, do we know which model Microsoft is using with its Bing search and that sort of chat feature? Has it gotten access to 4? Mm-hmm. Is it on 3? Will it eventually get 4? Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, this is a great question, because when Bing Chat was originally released, it was kind of a mystery of like which model it was using. Bing called it its like Prometheus model, I believe. And people speculated that it was GPT-4 because it was way more advanced than what people had seen on ChatGPT. And this week, Microsoft confirmed that, in fact, it has been running on GPT-4 this entire time. So we kind of have already gotten a sneak peek at kind of some of its real-world applications and what it can and can't do, and obviously some of its limitations as well, as we've seen Bing Chat kind of go off the rails a little bit. And so they've already had to limit it a little bit, so it might have been a bit of a test run for GPT-4. But short answer, yes, it's on GPT-4.
Got it. And then my last question for you, you actually wrote a piece over on Semaphore called Should We Be Polite to ChatGPT? So I thought it would be fitting to ask you, should we be polite to ChatGPT? Essentially, what did you find in kind of looking into this question? And of course, as you mentioned, going through Reddit and seeing how everybody's trying to poke and prod to make it do different things.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's no singular right answer. I guess I can speak from a personal point of view, and I'm curious to hear yours as well, which I'll think. But I'm from the South. I'm in Atlanta here. I grew up, you know, always use your manners, please and thank you. And so I would find myself with ChatGPT always saying, you know, thank you if it gave me a really good answer, or if I had a kind of complicated question, I'd be like, please, like, do this, you know, sorry. and I found that so many people had that same experience where they just noticed that they couldn't help themselves but be polite to ChatGPT. But since writing that article, actually, I did a little bit, you know, read more on the research and talked to some experts about it and learned some of the limitations with treating these bots as if they're like sentient beings that we should, you know, use normal human manners to. It's kind of a lot of experts say it's kind of a distraction from focusing on the issues of like, why are they acting the way they're acting, or like who programmed them, or like how they were made, rather than just seeing them as these sentient bots. And we should use it more as a tool rather than like a friend. And so that's how I've started to see it more. And I'm not outwardly rude to it, because I think that's even weirder, but like some of the people on Reddit, but
yeah.
I no longer use like additional niceties, like, you know,
thank you.
And yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So I'm from the Midwest. Mm-hmm. I come from Missouri, and I definitely had that same mindset. When it does a great job, I say thank you.
Yeah.
There have even been some times where I felt bad asking it a certain question, because it's like, oh, that's a really difficult thing for it to understand. I don't know if it's going to get that. And I'm like, oh man, I don't even want to make it, you know, challenge it so much. And I have pulled away from that specific thing, but I still do say, I guess I never went into it doing the pleases, but always if it gave a good answer, I did say thank you afterward.
Like on a social media
post. It's just like express appreciation.
Thumbs up, a little reaction. Yeah.
It gives a pretty canned response, I feel, whenever you do say thank you. So I probably would get to a point, if I used it that often, I would get to a point where I would stop doing that. But I've always had a problem, though, because even though it's not a real thing, it's still in my head. Treat others as you want to be treated, and others could be human or otherwise. You know what I mean? You treat your pets how you want to be treated. And so that is still in my mind, and it still makes me uncomfortable. I remember I had a family friend staying with me, and they did not have an Echo at home. I had an Echo, and I came downstairs, and the Echo had not done what they had expected it to do. And so they were cursing at it jokingly, haha, funny, funny. And I was like, no, let's not do that, please. Thanks. Because not only is it just, I think, odd behavior for a human being, but also, in the case of Echo at the time, Amazon, of course, was collecting certain responses, particularly those that failed. And so I'm like, somebody's going to end up hearing that and think that this, you know, this household is just ridiculous. So there's always that in the back of my mind, too.
Yeah. And it was a common refrain on Reddit that, you know, we should be nice to the bots because they're going to become sentient one day and remember who was nice and who was mean to
them. Yes!
Mostly a joke, but it's
creating,
very funny.
You're creating a good habit.
About.
That's what I think it is. I think it's up to a point to where there will be a point, I'm imagining, somewhere down the line, I don't know when, but somewhere down the line, where these things and these, you know, these AIs like occupy some sort of a humanoid presence. And we will feel the need to say thank you and please, you know? So maybe it's just creating good habits.
Exactly. And research has shown that people are more likely to treat bots if they're more conversational and act more human-like, to treat them like humans. So I think it speaks more to the tech itself that, like, wow, this is becoming really good if so many people are treating it like it's a friend or like a human. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a date with GPT-4 later today, so it'll be awkward when it doesn't show up. But no, thank you so much for your time today, JD. Of course, folks can head over to semaphore.com to check out the great work that you're doing. But if they want to follow you online, where can they go to do that?
Yeah, Twitter's the best place, at JD Capeluto, which is my long last name, JD Capeluto on Twitter.
Awesome. Thank you. We appreciate you.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, JD. All right. Coming up, TikTok. Late yesterday, we found out that a ban is, here in the U.S. at least, more and more likely. And we've got some interesting information there, but also kind of like a little bit of, looking deeper into it. What might this actually look like? Because it's feeling like more and more like it's actually going to happen. So we'll talk about that in a second, though. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Decisions. Decisions gives IT and business experts the tools to automate anything that's happening inside of your company, all within one no-code platform. Decisions is proven to fix any business process and then prepare you to withstand economic uncertainty. Recession resilience requires a deliberate management of resources and the flexibility to adapt at a moment's notice. And the Decisions no-code environment makes it easy for your team to collaborate to build and adjust workflows, dynamic forms, and decisioning processes that fit your unique and ever-changing business needs. And that's just super important with today's IT talent shortage, especially. Decisions process automation software is a complete toolkit. It allows developers and business users alike to build applications and automations with no code required. It's so powerful. Their no code platform includes robust rules and workflow engines and a host of pre-built integrations that connect to any legacy system via API, all within a simple drag and drop visual interface design. So no understanding complex kind of constructions and code and everything to make this happen. It can be deployed on-prem or in the cloud. As you know, companies were caught flat-footed at the onset of the pandemic, but Decisions customers were actually fully equipped to respond. One of the country's largest private banks built an entire PPP loan application process for small businesses affected by COVID-19. And all it took them was just 2 days. They were the first to market. They issued $1 billion in loans before their competitors even started. That's the power right there of Decisions. Decisions lets you customize workflows to automate the small decisions, producing faster results with greater accuracy, allowing your team to focus on the important decisions. Scale your business to better serve your customers while reducing operational cost and saving your team valuable time. And here's one excellent example of how Decisions automation software can help. Otis Elevator. They implemented Decisions to run daily pulse checks across their 2 million units, operating globally, by the way. By finding potential problems before they occur, they avoid downtime and manage their service technicians efficiently. If you happen to be riding in an Otis elevator, you can rest assured that you're going to arrive safely to your destination. As a recession approaches, the durability of a business's foundation will directly impact its performance and ability to survive. So you got to ask yourself how strong your foundation is. Decisions automation platform provides the solution to any business challenge, automating anything and changing everything to improve your company's speed to market, your financial growth, and operational success. They help industry leaders alleviate bottlenecks and automate pain points in their business so you can do what you do best and change the world. To learn more about Decisions no-code automation platform and scope your free proof of concept, all you got to do is visit decisions.com/twit. That's decisions.com/twit. And we thank Decisions for their support of Tech News Weekly. Okay. So we've got TikTok on the mind, and TikTok ban, which we've talked about, you know, in very recent episodes. We've had guests on talking about the possibility of this. And this has kind of escalated just yesterday. The Biden administration demanded that ByteDance, the company that owns and operates TikTok, sell its stake in the company. And if this sounds familiar, it's because it is very familiar. I'll talk about that in a second. Also threatened that by not doing so, the app would face this nationwide ban. You might remember this happened a couple of years ago, right? Under the Trump administration, summer of 2020, the same demand was levied against the company, citing national security. There was a probe that began a few years earlier in 2019. Only difference now is just how much of a hold TikTok has in the U.S. Mm-hmm. compared to even then, 110 million monthly active users in the U.S. as of December. And, you know, like when I think about it, you know, then versus now, if the U.S. really had this axe to grind in both situations, it probably would have been a little easier to pull this off then than it's going to be now, right?
Or I think that's fair.
Yeah. So it's a different ballgame entirely. Especially when you consider ad revenue then versus now. Back in 2020, ad revenue for TikTok was expected to earn around $1.4 billion. 2021, that number was $4 billion. 2022 expected $12 billion. So there's just an insane amount of money pouring into TikTok, which just represents just how many users are there to receive these ads, essentially. Anyone who has designs to buy the company, of course, has to take all of this into consideration. They're going to be paying a heck of a lot more money for it now than they would have a couple of years ago.
Yeah, like Microsoft.
Yeah. Do you think they
were once rumored to be buying to be in.
That's right. I wonder if some of those names will resurface.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, you know, we're still
now that they've invested a bunch of money in OpenAI, though, I think they might not have the funds.
That might be the smarter way to go, too, yeah. Although both are probably smart in their own right. But yeah, that's a really, really good point. Obviously, none of this matters if the Chinese government decides that ByteDance should not sell the company. I don't know if there's such a case or if there is any case of a company like this existing in China without China having some sort of direct control over, you know, some of the decisions that it makes in this case. And there's just a part of me that, man, I just don't see China being like,
I don't know.
Okay, let's give in to what the U.S. says. You should probably sell your social media company.
I don't know what's but this is the thing. Usually, one would think that this would not be news if it wasn't something that they thought was a possibility.
Yeah.
At least that's how I look at sort of the meta game of it. Would the U.S. government not at least think that it's a possibility
that China would say,
yes, we'll sell.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Because why else would you even make that public? You would be doing those deals behind the scenes to see if it was even a possibility before you ever announced that you were saying that this was going to be, unless the U.S. government is doing this out loud so that we all know whenever China does say no, and then you don't have as much anger at the U.S. government, you know, for causing this to happen. So could be going either way, right?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because this is incredibly important where we're at politically right now. And as we head into, you know, in a couple of years, a major election coming up, right? Does the Biden administration follow through on this if and when China, you know, doesn't allow ByteDance to sell, which is, I mean, if I had to guess, that's where I would guess it's going. Obviously, we don't know yet, but I think it's hard to imagine that the administration would back down, especially because they already kind of did that a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
It was like we got here and then it kind of fizzled away and everybody pretended like it never happened. And then now we're back here again. And so I'd be really surprised if the Biden administration backed down and were like, oh, actually, okay, fine. People love their videos. We'll let it, you know, stick around. But I think a much bigger consideration, the Wall Street Journal pointed this out, is the strength that the Democratic Party has behind, you know, with TikTok kind of leading into another major election. You know, a lot of those younger voters.
Yeah.
that might feel pretty darn burned
and not only
by the Democratic president and the administration's decision to remove TikTok. And not only that, just the network effect of that network and those younger users being able to rally for the Democratic Party.
Right. That's what, yes, because that is a place where if they focus attention, they're going to reach so many young voters.
Yes. Yeah.
As opposed to taking away that platform. Oofa doofa.
I mean, yeah. So it gets really complicated from a timing perspective. And if it wasn't political already, which it is, I mean, that just makes it even more so.
I'm so happy to be no part of any of the decision making here because this is just too complicated. But again, I have to go back to like, I was thinking, I genuinely, when I read about this morning, as I was getting ready for the day and ready to come in to work, I was thinking, I was asking myself, does the federal government know something? Of course, in general, this question that I'm about to ask, yes.
Yeah.
But I'm speaking specifically about this. Does the federal government know something that we don't? Mm. Like, what is it about TikTok? Is every single phone, I don't know, emitting some low frequency sound?
Right.
Like, what is it that they're so afraid of TikTok having a space in the United States? Because with TikTok, I am not going in and like handing over my credit card information. I'm not going in and putting in my health information. The only thing that I'm doing is watching videos, and typically I rarely even interact with anything there. I open it up, I let the videos play, I occasionally hit the heart, mm-hmm. or I occasionally follow someone, but most of the time it's just looking at a For You page and just scrolling through. So it's not as if this app is getting any more information than any other app on my phone. I don't even know if it gets my location information because I don't think that I've ever enabled it. Yeah, because I don't have a reason to give it my location information. I'm not posting on it. I'm just a watcher. So I don't think it's ever even asked me for that. So I don't get this, it just seems so weird, this huge fear about TikTok whenever it's just an app for looking at videos. So is it secretly doing something? What do they know that we don't? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the heart of it is the value of data, period. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we talk about algorithms and TikTok's algorithm being really great, you don't have to be interacting with TikTok by giving thumbs up or anything like that for TikTok to know a lot about the things that you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just merely by scrolling through the feed and stopping on a video, you've just sent some sort of a signal to TikTok that says, oh, this actually caught my attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So that creates a profile around users. I think that's only one aspect of it.
So then the Chinese government takes
what do they do with that?
Clones of Americans and like programs them with our
who
likes.
The heck knows?
That's
so
what I don't
right.
get.
I completely understand. Yeah.
The only thing I could think is you get what Americans pay attention to or don't pay attention to, and then you can create propaganda that you then serve into these different platforms, and in that way you can affect elections. That's the closest I can think of what this could be.
Is there a sneaky backdoor kind of influence campaign happening where, you know, all these funny dance trends that we think are just funny dance trends? No, there's something very illicit going on. Government has created those dance trends because they understand that if you do that dance, then you are something something.
It reminds me a little bit of my childhood. It came from at one point, family was super, super, super religious. And I can remember one of my family members sitting us down and talking to us about like all of these different name brands and different things that people did. So one was just like yoga, and they had like a person doing a yoga pose. And then there was this snake that was like superimposed over the top of it. And it's like, when you do this yoga pose, you're worshiping Satan.
Oh no.
And then like the Monster energy drink can is actually 666 and all.
Right.
Like, this is what it kind of reminds me of, that people are going, oh yeah, that, you know, the government is subliminally messaging you or something. Government, is that what's happening? Because otherwise, I really struggle to see why this wave
necessary.
Is it not kind of Red Scare?
Kind of, yeah. That's a good comparison. But, and I wish that we knew more to know whether, you know, what that is.
I have to tell you though, this is one of the scariest topics to talk about on the show, because I have gotten more feedback than I think I ever have in the history of working at Twit over talking to the TechCrunch reporter, was it last week or a couple of weeks ago, about TikTok banned the United States. People have feelings. People do not like China.
Amanda Silberling.
Yeah, Amanda, thank you. Amanda Silberling. And there is this huge distrust and dislike that has people going super patriotic and super, again, super that's for, where super it does feel red scare again.
Yeah, right.
That's what it feels like.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting. One thing that I'll be curious about, because it really does seem to me like the writing is on the wall. Mm-hmm. There are an insane amount of U.S. creators, and I know that this is maybe, you know, this is maybe a small part of the pie as far as like concerns about this, but U.S. creators out there, they better be have already made their plans, you know, to bring their viewers over to wherever they happen to be going. They better have a backup plan, because it'll be interesting if at some point suddenly that siphon is cut off, and what do you do? You've created all of this momentum, and then poof, it goes away. Right. And if you haven't signaled to those people, you're going over there now. And then I think the other consideration before we kind of move on is how the other social media networks, you know, are probably responding to this. Meta, for example, you know, they've been hurting.
They really have
in recent months, and just faced another major round of layoffs. And you know, I imagine something like this, that, you know, whether they're public about it or not, they're like, oh man, you mean to tell me that our biggest competitor, our biggest competitor right now, could just go away poof like that. Yeah. I don't know that necessarily means suddenly their business comes back strong, but it certainly makes things a little bit easier for them. So that's interesting too. Yeah. Very interesting. That's where we're at. Don't send Micah tons of hate mail about TikTok. We're just talking about the possibilities. We're honestly, what it is, we're just trying to understand beyond the kind of nationalistic kind of impulse to say, well, the Biden administration says TikTok is bad because Chinese government. Okay, but why? I would love to understand it. And if I understood, then, you know, maybe I'd feel differently.
There was a compelling message that someone shared in the Discord. It was a report from The Guardian, and it says why concerns over your data are here to stay regarding TikTok's ties to China. And there is, it says, This data collection threatens to allow the Chinese Communist Party access to Americans' personal and proprietary information. This, the order claimed, paves the way for China to track the locations of government employees, build dossiers for blackmail, and conduct corporate espionage. So this is where I could see if you've got, so of course, ban TikTok for government officials. That's fine. I get it. I understand that, because if you are sharing location data and then you've got all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if the Chinese government could then target a specific phone that is running TikTok and somehow bypass, you know what I mean? That is where it starts to make sense. I totally understand that. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to that kind of thing, given the possibility of those kinds of targeted attacks, sure, I get the concern. And that is why I was very much like, on board an understanding of different government officials or different governments, just in general, the UK, the US, making the choice to make TikTok not available to government employees. Mm. But outside of that, that's where I'm still going, okay, can you explain what that means for me?
Right.
Yeah. why I should be concerned about that. So anyway, we're just asking the questions.
We're just asking.
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Don't hate us. That's what we do here. We ask questions. This is literally what we do half this show, is ask people questions.
Indeed.
So why don't we ask ourselves some questions too? So there we go. That's what we got.
All right, folks. Microsoft Copilot is on its way. I'll talk about what the heck that is in a moment. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Everyone knows honeypots are a great idea. I mean, bears know honeypots are a great idea, but those aren't the honeypots we're talking about. We're talking about the ones where a sneaky bad actor is looking around on the network and they find this vulnerable device and they can hop in and grab what they're looking for. So think about this. If everyone knows that honeypots are a great idea, why don't all internal networks run them? Well, it's a simple answer. Because with all our network problems, nobody needs one more machine to administer and worry about. We know the benefits that honeypots can bring, but the cost and effort of deployment always drop honeypots to the bottom of the list of things to do. Thinkst Canary is your way to solve this problem. See, canaries can be deployed in minutes, even on incredibly complex networks, giving you all of the benefits without the admin downsides. The canary triggers are simple. If someone is accessing your Lure files or brute forcing your fake internal SSH server, you have a problem. Canary uses deceptively uncomplicated, high-quality markers of trouble on your network. Here's how it works. You simply choose a profile for the canary device, such as a Windows box, a brand name router, or a Linux server. If you want, you can further tweak the services your canary runs. You may need a specific IIS server version, OpenSSH, or a Windows file share with actual files constructed according to your naming scheme. And then lastly, you register your canary with the hosted console for monitoring and notifications. Then you wait. Attackers who have breached your network, malicious insiders, and other adversaries make themselves known by accessing your canary. There's little room for doubt. If someone browsed a file share and opened a sensitive-looking document on your canary, you'll immediately be alerted to the problem. And if you're curious about how this has worked for other people, you can view the testimonials at canary.tools/love and see why customers on all seven continents love their Thinkst canaries. Deploy your birds and forget about them. They remain silent until they're needed. You can get one alert via email, text, Slack, webhook, or syslog, and you get it only when it matters. Visit canary.tools/twit, and for just $7,500 per year, you will get 5 canaries, your own hosted console, you'll get upgrades, you'll get support, you'll get maintenance, and by the way, if you use code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box, you're also going to get 10% off the price, and that's for life. Thinkst Canary adds incomparable value, but if you're unhappy, you can always return your canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. However, and this is incredible, during all the years that we at TWIT have partnered with Thinkst Canary, their refund guarantee has never needed to be claimed.
That's crazy.
Never needed to be claimed. These the folks who have gotten it, they get their Thinkst Canaries. They see how great they are. They don't need to return them. So visit canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box to check out Thinkst Canary. And our thanks to Thinkst Canary for supporting this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All right, back from the break, and that means it's time for my story of the week. I am talking about the very newly announced Microsoft Copilot. You may have heard of Clippy. This is the new version of Clippy. So remember back, some of you, back in the day when you'd open up a Microsoft Word document and you'd start typing in your name, your address, you'd type in maybe the header education, and then you'd underline it, and then you were getting ready to put in your education that you've had, and then the little clip, the little paperclip pops up and goes, "Hey! It looks like you're trying to write a resume. Would you like some help with that?" That's how I imagine it sounds. It didn't actually have a voice. It just was text.
Who was the voice of Clippy?
Eventually, it was Gilbert Gottfried.
Gilbert Gottfried. Yeah. That's right.
And I'm not doing that impression. So in my head, he sounds like this. Anyway.
I think it's appropriate.
Yeah. Clippy would try to help, and Clippy was almost never good at actually helping and just kind of got in the way. So many people disabled Clippy. Well, now there's Microsoft Copilot, and Microsoft Copilot is a version of Clippy, kind of, that is kind of sitting beside all of your Microsoft 365 stuff, and in particular, your Microsoft 365 Office documents. Running Copilot is GPT-4 from OpenAI. So, of course, we know that Microsoft has invested a bunch of money into OpenAI and has added OpenAI's GPT-4 to its Bing search engine. Along with doing that with Bing, they did say they were going to roll it out to the Microsoft 365 apps and services, and that has officially happened. In fact, it was just this morning that they announced it. So some of the things that in this Verge article they talk about is that you can have it summon, or you can have it generate text and documents. You could have it create PowerPoint presentations based on a Word document. So you could say, hey, here's this document that I have. Can you make a PowerPoint presentation out of it? Or, and I know a lot of you folks out there who just love pivot tables in Excel. There's also, yeah, like,
whoo, fanning myself.
Keep talking. Yes. I love my pivot tables. If you love your pivot tables, well, or maybe it's not you want to love pivot tables, then Copilot can come along and help you out with that. So you can summon it kind of anywhere in the Microsoft 365 documents, or rather suite like Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook, Teams, and it's going to be coming to Microsoft Teams soon. It's not there yet. So with that, you will get the ability to, for example, provide some information on an upcoming meeting that you'll have. So maybe there was an agenda attached to it whenever the event went out. I could see it being used. You know, we have a weekly meeting and we have a sort of spreadsheet that has all of the information in it for that meeting. And it tends to get put in at least an hour or so before the meeting. So if we were doing it on Microsoft side, we could say to Copilot, what's today's meeting going to be about? And it could quickly kind of generate some information about that meeting. It will help you create different changes and documentation for your organization. It's also great at helping to update people. So I love this example. What if you have a couple of people who are on your team and you're all working on a project together, and these couple of people go on vacation, and when they get back, they need to get caught up? Well, Copilot can give them the rundown of what they missed while they were out. You can get it in, as I mentioned, Word, where you are able to say, hey, take all of this information that I have and combine it into one document. You can have it, you know, create analyses in Excel. There's so much stuff that can be done with this. And I think it's kind of incredible it's not just so. What we've seen GPT-4 be used for up to this point, because it's relatively new, is kind of one step or one window kind of responses, right? Mm-hmm. So you would get, you type in and you say, hey, help me with this, like we showed earlier, an HTML and JavaScript website. And it's all happening right there. But with Copilot, because it's getting plugged into all of these different parts of Microsoft's system, then suddenly it can take a Word document and then open up PowerPoint and start to create the PowerPoint page for you. The possibilities are just kind of mind-boggling, and I can't even sort of understand the scope of what's possible as we start to use these what is just essentially at its base a large language model to do so much more. Because mm-hmm. that's the thing. What we used to have is, and what we still do have in many cases, we talk to Siri, or we talk to the Google Assistant, or we talk to Amazon's Alexa. And when we're doing that, what's happening is it's taking what we're saying and it is going, in many cases, off to a server, sometimes locally on the chip, and it is figuring out what we want and then turning that into code that the system can understand and then providing a response. Mm-hmm. But it is limited in doing that. And so oftentimes you have to say things in a specific way. If you don't properly put the direction. Yes, the syntax is so incredibly important.
Yeah.
With this, suddenly we're at a place where it doesn't really matter the syntax. Mm-mm. And because it doesn't matter the syntax on either side. What I mean by that is what we say in isn't as important, and kind of what the initial system takes from that isn't as important, because what ends up happening is the large language model can work in both places. It can work between us and the machine, and then from the machine back, so that it can properly parse and know what it needs to say to the system and all of the places that it needs to say it.
To get the information it needs.
Exactly. Yeah. And to do the actions that it needs to do. So where you might think a large language model is at its basis just a chatbot, you input, it outputs. No, you can apply that large language model to so many different places. And as long as it's trained on how you have to talk to these different systems, then suddenly the possibilities are endless.
Yeah. One of the examples on the Verge site is this little animation within Outlook where it's like somebody is sending out an email to a coworker to ask them last minute to present for this thing. And it's this short little, you know, prompt that's given to the chatbot. But what it illustrates, I think this is it. What it illustrates is the chatbot is able to go into the, like, to understand the mail that has already been received, understand the speaker that this person is replacing, and understand the reason why that speaker can't speak anymore and that this person is needed. So from this small question of like, hey, can you, I want to write an email that asks this person last minute to fill in. And then the chatbot learns all this other stuff about it and says, hey, I'm really sorry to bother you last minute. So-and-so had to drop out, you know, very last minute and suddenly can't do this thing. We're hoping that you can do it or whatever. It fills in the gaps.
Yeah.
And that's impressive.
Yeah.
I mean,
I mean, from
because that's
not even a full sentence to this entire paragraph.
Totally. That's all that context. I could also see people being kind of freaked out or, you know, kind of like
you
nervous about the fact that like, oh, wait a minute, it knows all this, you know, what else does it know? But I mean, you know, you got to kind of, I think, pick, you know, what you want out of these systems.
Yeah,
do you want a system that is smart, that helps you in all these ways? Or do you want a totally dumb system? And you might want, and it's not a problem if you want a totally dumb system, as long as they'll allow it. Like, is this a feature that you can disable?
Right. Yes.
I don't know.
I'm sure
you could.
Can we show the GIF of the presentation? It's Copilot can generate a PowerPoint presentation for you in the Verge document. This is stupid. Like, are you serious? I say create a short presentation based on, and I use the little at sign, and then I point to a specific Microsoft Word document that I want to have the presentation made from. And then I thought it was just going to like generate the pages in PowerPoint. No, there are images in the background. The text looks super cool. The design is gorgeous. There are different types of slides. What? This is just next level. I'm blown away. I plan on making use of this because I do have a Microsoft 365 account for all the different documents. I'm going to be playing a lot with this because I just think even if it's not something that I would use in the long run, I think eventually we'll all be using this kind of stuff in the long run. But in the short run of the long run, if it's not something that I use,
short run of the long run,
I just find it all fascinating.
Yeah, it really is.
And it just, this is leaps and bounds beyond what Siri started out as, what, you know, clap on, clap off was. Like, this is just mind blowing at times. Oh, in fact, just this morning, I figured out, I didn't. OpenAI's ChatGPT figured out. It was partially me, partially ChatGPT, because I knew the formula that I needed to create around this, but I didn't know how to generate the regular expression, which for folks who don't know, regular expressions are this, it's sort of a way to tell the machine how to search for and find a specific term or terms. So you were trying to say like, I want you to find all of the words or symbols or whatever after this specific phrase in this whole document. It's like find and replace, but it's more powerful and you can get very specific. And I am not a regex, as it's called, a regex expert. And so I needed some help. So I went into ChatGPT this morning and I said, this is what I'm trying to find, or this is the regex that I want to do. I want to find this specific series of words after this this head. And can you do that? And then the first thing it generated for me when I tested it, it was doing more than it was supposed to. And so I said, I've got a problem. It's not doing this properly. And it's like, oh yeah, that's true. It wouldn't do that. Here's why it wouldn't do that, but here's how you make it do that. Mm. And then I created the rest of the formula. And what that does is, in our Tech News Weekly, spreadsheet that, Jason and I use, at the end of every interview, we have this section that says, thank you so much for joining us. And then it's the person's name. And then we ask, like, where can we find you online? That's just a reminder to us so that we remember to ask those kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. So the thing that I made was a formula, because we also have a different area where we put in the person's name and we put in what we want to have in their lower third or what they want to have in their lower third. So I created a little formula that looks in that box for the person's name and then automatically generates that text that goes in at the end. Thanks so much for joining us. So basically it just keeps us from having to write it twice. So I was going to tell you, I have added that to the template now.
Wow. Okay.
And so, yes, now it can automatically, basically all you got to do is put the name in the orange box and then it will automatically populate in that phrase down at the bottom. And ultimately, that's neat. Yeah, it's not something super important, but I knew that I could do it and I knew I needed regular expressions to make it happen. And so I was able to create that using, with the help of ChatGPT. It filled in for me where I wasn't able to do that on my own in a short period of time. And that is what I think is super cool. This sidekick that we now have.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's pretty rad.
Yeah,
nice. I didn't even notice that you had done that. That's how it works.
It just looks like it normally does.
That's so crazy.
But yeah, I'll change it.
I would have gone, had you not told me, I would have gone in there like next week to like edit it or whatever and couldn't, you know, be surprised that there's just a bunch of code there.
And now you'll see it changed to your name there
at the bottom. That's right. So interesting. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you.
Things like these becoming more and more real and normal because, you know, systems like ChatGPT will make it.
It filled in
so much
for
easier.
Me where I didn't have that knowledge.
Yeah.
And
that's really cool.
Even whenever it, you know, so I will,
because I wondered how to do that sort of stuff too, you know, and sometimes it's like, how do I even search
how
to find
the answer?
How do you
start to get that answer? Yeah. And what was interesting, so our guest today, JD, is J period D period. And the original regular expression did not take into, it was only looking for letters. And so it did not take into account the periods. And so when I used it, then it just stopped at the J and it didn't go to the end of the line essentially. And so I went back and I said, hey, I've got a problem. It is the person's name that I'm using has periods in it. How do I solve for that? And I was like, oh, here's how you solve for that. And so then I was able to create the proper regular expression.
With wow.
That. Very cool
That's
stuff.
Really cool. Very, very neat. Well, Nate, well, this is why we keep talking about AI.
Yeah. it's so cool.
Because it's very, very cool. And it's obviously.
Or it can be. It can be very cool.
It's obviously a very big thing that we're at the beginning of and kind of following through. It'd be really interesting. You know, I think we say this every time we talk about AI, but really interesting to see where we are in a couple of years, 5 years as a result of this, because this isn't. You know, this discussion was on Twig yesterday. Like, is this like, you know, other flash in the pan things? Are we just excited about it because it's now?
New and now.
It's like, no, you know, this is different. This is like a major paradigm shift.
Absolutely.
In computing. And it's going to change.
I just saw this morning that Apple has been experimenting with some AI, some generative AI stuff for Siri on Apple TV. So now we've got many of the major players all looking at generative AI as part of their platform. So I think we'll continue to see that.
Yep. And we'll continue to talk about it here on Tech News Weekly.
This very show.
We do this show every Thursday, twit.tv/TNW. That's where you can subscribe to the show in audio and video formats because it is, after all, a podcast. So subscribe. That's the way to do it.
And if you would like to get all of our shows ad-free, well, I've got a way for you to do that. It's called Club Twit at twit.tv/clubtwit. For starting at $7 a month or $84 a year, you out there can join the club. And when you do, you get some great things. First, you get every single Twit show with no ads. You get your own kind of personal feeds in our site. And then you get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. Behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, special Club Twit events all get posted there. It's a great bunch of content that otherwise you wouldn't have, as well as access to the members-only Discord server. That is a place where you can go to chat with all of your fellow Club Twit members and those of us here at Twit as well. My co-host for iOS Today, she is incredibly active in the Club Twit Discord, Rosemary Orchard. So please join the club. I mentioned starting at $7 a month because we heard from some folks who said, hey, I really feel like I'm getting so much value out of this. I'd like to be able to give you more than $7 a month. I think it's worth more than $7 a month. So Patrick Delahanty flipped a switch and made it possible for you to choose to give more. And I think the reason why folks did that is because I kept seeing new shows and new content making its way into the club. We have several shows that are Club Twit exclusives. And in fact, we continue to see the club grow because of that, I think. First is the Untitled Linux Show. It is, as you might imagine, a show all about Linux. So for all of you Linux fans out there, you could join the club. We also have Paul Thurrott's Hands on Windows program. That is a program, a short format show that has Paul Thurrott covering tips and tricks and everything in between for Windows. And then you've also got my show, Hands on Mac, which is a show all about Apple's devices. I've been doing a lot of Mac stuff, all sorts of tips and tricks there, and have just recently, actually the show that'll publish later today is about Safety Check, which is a way for you to kind of look at what apps, maybe TikTok on your phone, are monitoring your data, your location, your photos, all that kind of stuff, and quickly make changes to that. And then also the newly revived Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson. Yes, that show is now on Club Twit. So excited to have that show back. And honestly, it's worth it just to hear Mr. Wilkinson's excellent and jolly laugh. Again, all available as part of Club Twit, twit.tv/Club Twit. We love it if you joined us there. And we thank you so much for your support. If you want to follow me online or check out all the great work, wait, I won't say it's great work. It may be great work, but that's your choice to make. Great work is in the eye of the beholder. If you want to follow me online, check out the work that I'm doing. You can find me at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. And please check out my shows again, Hands on Mac, which we'll publish later today. Sunday, where I record Ask the Tech Guys with Leo Laporte, where we take your questions live and do our best to answer those. And then Tuesdays, where I record iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard. Great show. Jason Howell, what about you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Jason Howell, on Mastodon, twit.social/@JasonHowell, doing all about Android every Tuesday, twit.tv/AAA. In fact, next Tuesday on All About Android will be my last show on the Twit network, and then I go on vacation.
Oh, last show for a while.
..
Yeah.
And then I will be back, but I'm going to be gone. I won't be on this show for 3 weeks, so I'm going to be not here. And I will miss you all terribly, but I will be back. We're going to Costa Rica.
I'll be back.
So can't wait for that. Big vacation coming up. Looking forward to it. So you can find me on All But Android next Tuesday. And then that's kind of it for a few weeks. Big thanks to everybody here in the studio for helping us with our shows. John, Burke, everybody behind the scenes. Anthony, I'm sure, helped out at some point with some AI thing. I don't know. We appreciate everything that you all do to keep the show going. And thanks to you for watching and listening. For without you, we would not be able to keep the show going. So thank you. And we'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, but your game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. You already knew all that. What you may not know is that TwitNow has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.